Hello, everyone. We are continuing on with Thomas Manton, a practical exposition upon the 53rd chapter of Isaiah. Last time we finished verse 2, "For he shall grow up before him as a tender plant and as a root out of a dry ground. He hath no form nor comeliness, and when we shall see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him." We did an overall third point, which was some practical points and observations concerning man in the ordering of his life and behavior. And that brought us to the end of verse 2. And Lord willing, we're going to continue on with verse 3 this time. And I'll go ahead and read that now and start. "He is despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we esteemed him not." Now, the prophet proceeds now to the second scandal and offense that the Jews took against Christ, who therefore would not believe the report that was made of him. The first was Christ's meanness or lowness in his birth and life, which we have handled in the second verse. The next is his sufferings, and those are either of his life or of his death, which are set forth in diverse verses following. In this verse, the prophet's expressions do chiefly hint the sufferings of his life. Here are diverse phrases which discover the several degrees of Christ's sufferings, though I shall not give them to you in the order of the words, because the expressions lie scattered here and there. The degrees are these. Number one, he was not esteemed. Number two, he was actually despised and became an object of scorn and contempt. Number three, he was liable to great miseries. And number four, he was continually pestered with them. This is the sum of this verse. I will make it out unto you from the phrases opened as the text presents them. Number one, he is despised and rejected of men. That which we read rejected of men, the Hebrew signifies the leaving off of men. It may bear a double interpretation. Number one, that Christ was so extremely mean or low and miserable that it was impossible to be lower as a man. He was, Latin words, the minimum, quote, sick of a man. If he had gone any lower, we must have had some other name for him. In this sense, it is said in Psalm 22:6, "I am a worm and no man, a reproach of men and despised of the people." You must seek for some name for him among the worms. Number two, the leaving off of men. That is, there men left him. They would converse with any other, but not with him. Nobody would deign him speech and company. He was the least of all. Our interpretation seems to favor this exposition. There is not much matter which you prefer. Number two, a man of sorrows, the next words in the verse, or other words in the verse, a Hebraism to express the height of misery. They use the genitive case of the substantive to express the superlative degree of anything, as a man of Belial for a very wicked man, so a psalm of degrees or an excellent psalm. This expression compels some of the wiser Jews to feign two messiahs, one that has already come, that walks up and down on the earth under the shape of a beggar, that he may satisfy for the sins of the Jews, and is in a great deal of misery. The other, a glorious king, whom they do as yet expect. And that is the second expression. Number three, acquainted with grief, or knowing diseases, that is, by his own experience. Disease is put for any kind of trouble or molestation, because they are the things that are most irksome. For otherwise, Christ, though he had many griefs, yet he had no diseases, these usually arising out of some intemperance or badness of constitution, neither of which agree to Christ. He took our personal, not individual, infirmities. Hunger and thirst he was acquainted with, not stone or gout or fever. Number four, and we hid, as it were, our faces from him, or as it is in the margin, he hid, as it were, his face from us. The Hebrew will bear both ways. It is either a hiding faces from him or from us. Since the text does so indifferently allow of both these renderings, I shall show you the sense of both. He hid his face from us, which the Septuagint follows, Septuagint being the Greek translation of the Old Testament. His face was turned away, as it were, in modesty, say some, as if he were ashamed of the meanness or lowness of his condition, but that is unworthy of Christ. The Chaldee paraphrase seems to hint another sense. He hid the countenance of his divine majesty. That is probable, but does not thoroughly reach the force of the expression. Others say thus, he hid his face as a person doomed to die, as sentenced persons had their faces covered, or when much discountenanced. Thus Haman, when in displeasure with the king, in Esther 7 verse 8, it is said his face was covered. So in great sorrow and mourning, thou shalt cover thy face, Ezekiel 12 verse 6. Or it is more properly in shame, or as a token of being unworthy of the society of men. So it was with the lepers, who by the law were to put a covering upon the upper lip, Leviticus 13:45. It is not difficult to reconcile any of these senses with the matter in hand. But let us consider the other reading, we hid our faces from him. This is a natural gesture and at all times signifies some abomination and withdrawing of the mind from a thing. But sometimes it is in one affection and sometimes in another, as number one, sometimes in anger, to hate them so as we will not give them a look. Thus God is said to hide his face from his church to express his anger against their sins. Number two, sometimes in shame, we turn away from them as rich men do from their poor friends. They scorn to give them a look. Number three, sometimes in pity, it is such a sad sight that we dare not look on it. I rather prefer that of a scornful shame, being ashamed to follow such a poor, mean, or low, and miserable man. And thus many now hide their faces from Christ, when it is disgraceful to close with him. There is nothing now remains that is difficult, only it follows he was despised and looked upon as a man leprous whose face should be hid, and therefore we did not esteem him worthy of our company. The sum of the verse amounts to thus much, that Jesus Christ was so miserable in regard of his outward face and appearance that he was looked upon as an abject, as a man not fit to be kept company with. I shall only note these two things more for explication, because upon them I shall build 2 points, which shall be all I will handle out of this verse. These 2 points, number one, some of these expressions set out Christ as indeed he was. Number two, some only as he was in the apprehensions of men. He was in himself a man of sorrows, but in the eye of man, he was a despised and an abject person. The one is the cause or the occasion of the other. And the prophet so intermingles these two things in this verse that the phrases may be taken both ways, how Christ was in himself and how he was to men. Now, number one, as he was in himself, and from thence I observe this point, doctrine number one, that Christ's appearance in the world and state of life among men was not only very mean, but very miserable. And number two, from men's judgment of him, upon this account I observe, doctrine two, that carnal men do not look upon Jesus Christ as worthy of any esteem from them. Now I shall begin with the first, vis-a-vis, doctrine number one, that Christ's appearance in the world and state of life among men was not only very mean or low, but very miserable. I shall take the several degrees in the text to make it out unto you. Number one, the lowest step is negative. He was not esteemed. He had not that due respect and value in the world that he might justly look for. And it is a misery to be slighted by those to whom we intend the greatest good. It was much that they should not own him as some eminent man. It was more that they would not give him the respect due to any man, to an ordinary prophet. John 1 verse 11, he came to his own and his own received him not. There is an emphasis in the words his own, those over whom he had a special care and to whom he meant the greatest good. Mark, everything else acknowledged Christ, but man would not. The angels ushered in his birth, Luke 2:14. The wind and the seas obeyed him, Matthew 8:27. The fish paid his tribute to him, Matthew 17:27. The wild beasts, when he was in the wilderness, would not touch him, Mark 1:13. The Holy Ghost would have us to note it as a special circumstance that he was in the wilderness 40 days and he was with the wild beasts. Nay, the very devils confessed him, Luke 8:28. The man that had many devils fell down before him and cried out, and with a loud voice said, "What have I to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of God Most High?" Yet man would not own him. They thought anyone was more like to be the Messiah than he. John, though he never did miracles nor taught with such authority as Christ did, yet they sent an honorable message to him, John 1:19. The Jews sent priests and Levites from Jerusalem to ask him whether he was the Christ or no. But now they never sent an honorable embassy to Christ, never put him to the question, but only in a scoff asked him whether he were the Christ or no. Yet John gave them as much ground of distaste as Christ did, freely taxing their sins. John was sent to in an honorable way because he was a priest's son, but Christ only a carpenter's son. Therefore, Christ was not esteemed. Anything is enough to prejudice them that are not affected to a thing or way. Nay, they not only preferred John before him, though famous for no miracles, but even Barabbas before him, John 18:40, when Pilate said, "Will ye that I release unto you the King of the Jews?" Then cried they all, saying, "Not this man, but Barabbas." Now Barabbas was a robber, any rather than Christ. They had very little esteem of Christ, you see, and this fault is objected to them. Indeed, it was a great aggravation of their guilt. It was objected to them. Acts 3:14, "Ye have denied the Holy One and the just, and desired a murderer to be granted unto you, even a cruel highwayman before Christ." Esteeming is a relative word, and it implies everyone, even the worst of men, to be higher in their thoughts than Christ. Number two, as he was not esteemed, so actually he was despised and became an object of scorn and contempt. Number one, he was despised and contemned in their thoughts. They looked upon him as an abject, the leaving off or offscouring of men. They thought it was a disgrace for them to converse with him. And therefore Nicodemus went to Christ by night, John 3 verse 2, as being ashamed to be seen in his company by day. So John 9:22, the blind man's parents that had received a great benefit by him would make a lie rather than own him. It is said, "These words spake his parents because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had agreed already that if any man did confess that he was Christ, he should be put out of the synagogue." They thought him unworthy of their company, and therefore everyone hid his face from him and would not seem to look that way. Number two, in their words, they used all kinds of reproaches. They thought no name bad enough for him. John 8:48, "Say we not well that thou art a Samaritan and hast a devil?" There was such a deadly feud between the Jews and the Samaritans that to call a man a Samaritan was the greatest disgrace that could be, in the ready way to beget him public hatred. Here are two scandals fixed on Christ, a Samaritan and one that has a devil. The one reflects upon his person, the other on his doctrine. And that which is worthy of your notice is that to that of his doctrine Christ answers, but does not care how they vilified his person. In Matthew 11:19, they call him a glutton, a winebibber, and a friend of publicans and sinners. They looked upon him as an object of common scorn and hatred, so they accounted him as an enemy to Caesar. Anything that would make him obnoxious or liable to danger and scorn. They likewise called him a deceiver, Matthew 27:63, "Sir, we remember that that deceiver said while he was yet alive, proud, insulting malice. They would not call him by his own name, but as if he had been so notoriously guilty that it was a sufficient description of him to say that deceiver." Number three, in their general carriage toward him, to any that seemed to own him, they showed a great deal of contempt and scorn. Because the blind man acknowledged him, they cast him out or excommunicated him, John 9:34. So John 7:52, by way of taunt, they said, "Art thou also of Galilee?" But chiefly their behavior to his person was intolerable, and that in the last scene of his life, Matthew 26:68, the rude soldiers make him their game, and blinding him, say, "Prophesy unto us, thou Christ, who is he that smote thee?" So it is prophesied, Matthew 20:19, "They shall deliver him to the Gentiles to mock and to scourge and to crucify him." There is a special emphasis in these words that he, being a Jew, should be delivered over to the Gentiles to be mocked, scourged, and crucified. Nothing was more vile and abominable, insomuch that they would not come into the place where Pilate sat judging for fear of being contaminated, John 18:28, and they themselves went not into the judgment hall, lest they should be defiled. Therefore, it was that Pilate went forth to them, for they would not come in. Look, as it was an aggravation of David's fault that he made Uriah to be slain with the sword of the children of Ammon, 2 Samuel 12:9. So it was of the Jews' contempt that they should deliver him to the Gentiles to be mocked and scourged. And thus you see how he was despised and looked upon as an abject. Number three, a man of sorrows. This notes the multitude of his afflictions and the greatness of them. He was a man assaulted with all kinds of sorrows and grievously afflicted with them. A man of sorrows, that is, a man of miseries. The affection is put for the condition because they left a great impression upon him. All kinds of sorrows he endured for our sakes, as scoffs, persecution, contempt, unkindness, miseries, hunger, thirst, faintness, and weariness. I might tire you with a woeful variety of this nature. The scriptures everywhere testify of it. Let me briefly tell you that they were as much as might fit him to be a mediator. His sufferings are to be measured by his mediatorship. And then they were such as might stand with the holiness of his person. Now these sufferings were the more grievous to him because his senses were most quick and smart, and therefore he must needs, above other men, have a sensible apprehension of what was done to him. The best constitutions have the most vigorous affections, and therefore it could not be but that all these sufferings should leave very dolorous impressions upon the Spirit of Christ. And indeed, it is more than probable that he was so wasted with them, I guess, or tired from them, and they had so dried up the moisture and freshness of his countenance that when he was little above 30, they thought him near 50 years of age. John 8:57, "Thou art not yet 50 years old, and hast thou seen Abraham?" He was little above 30, but griefs blasting his beauty, he might appear more aged than he was. And thus you see, he was a man of sorrows. I do not touch upon the last scene of his death. The sorrows of his life justly give him that character, even without the last scene of his life. Number four, acquainted with grief. It was not only now and then, but it was always miserable with him. Acquaintance with a thing or person implies the usualness of it. Now, Christ was acquainted with grief, that is, accustomed to it, never freed from it. As soon as he began to live, he began to suffer. He was exiled and forced to fly into Egypt as soon as he was a month old, and ever afterward hunted up and down by the Pharisees. Trace him through all the scenes of his life, from the cradle to the cross, from the stable to Golgotha, and you shall see that grief was his familiar. He had no other companion. It is an observation in that letter that Lentulus sent concerning him, if that letter be not forged, that he was often seen to weep, never to laugh, being always acquainted with grief. Now, that's not from the Bible, but that is from another writer. And in regard of those cruel persecutions that did constantly attend him, he is called in the title of that psalm that sets out the misery of his life, in Psalm 22, the Hind of the Morning, M-O-R-N. See the title, A Psalm Concerning Aegeleth Shehar, that is, Christ, who was always from the very morning, in the morning, the beginning of the day, he was always hunted and worried by the dogs. He complains of it in that psalm in verse 16, the dogs have compassed me. The dogs hunted him in the morning early and betimes. Herod, one of the dogs, as soon as he was born, endeavors to murder him. So at the time of Christ's death, the Holy Ghost gives us this circumstance in John 18:28, that they led Christ from Caiaphas unto the judgment hall, and it was early in the morning. The bloodhounds were up to worry him betimes in the morning. And well, you see, Christ was acquainted with grief, even early, from his first breath to his last gasp, from his lying in the cradle to his consummatum est, which is Latin words, on the cross. Nay, it is very observable that in the short glory of his transfiguration, he was not without sorrow, for even then he remembered his death to come, as you shall see in Luke 9:31, when Moses and Elias appeared to him in glory. They spake of his decease, which should be accomplished at Jerusalem. And in the midst of his glory, he would remember his death. And therefore, you see, well might the prophet use the expression acquainted with grief. So much for the determination of the point to prove to you that Christ's state of life was so miserable in the world. I shall now show you why he was so miserable. Why did he undergo all these sorrows? It is a profitable question, as the former for our meditation, so this for our faith. The causes either respect God or the creature. First, in respect of God, and so it was, number one, that his promises might be fulfilled. God had foretold it, so by the prophets, Mark 9:12, it is written of the Son of Man that he must suffer many things and be set at naught, N-O-U-G-H-T, or nothing. Now this sentence is nowhere in one prophet, but the meaning is, it is the constant drift and result of all that is written concerning the Messiah, that he must suffer many things and be counted as nothing, though he alludes specially to this chapter in the 22nd Psalm. This was so far from being a scandal against Christ that it rather confirmed him to be the Messiah, for he was just such a one as was promised and prophesied of. Number two, that he might declare his obedience to God's decrees and appointment. It is said, Hebrews 5:8, that he learned obedience by the things that he suffered. He did, by experience, find what it was to have a father whom he must obey, though otherwise he were every way equal to him. But the excellency of his person exempted him not from suffering. For, having taken our debt upon him, his holy life was a part of his obedience to his Father, but his sufferings showed a higher degree of it, which made him a full and complete mediator. To obey God in the ordinary way of our actions is a common lesson to every holy person. But Christ's obedience was chiefly tried by his sufferings because, being without sin, he never deserved it. Now, thus much in respect of God. Secondly, in respect of men. And so, number one, that he might set off his love to us. Usually, they are dearer to us that have suffered anything for our sakes than they that have otherwise done us good. And therefore, Christ, to set off his love, spent a miserable 32 years and upwards in the world, and afterwards died a terrible death, and that not for himself, but for us. Some say it was to merit his own glory, but it is not good to divert the stream, or any part of it, from that channel in which Christ intends it should run. Daniel 9:26, the Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. Christians, all his sufferings were for you. Number two, that he might be a perfect mediator for us. Christ was perfect in himself, but he wanted or lacked somewhat to make up his office. Hebrews 2:10, it behooved the captain of our salvation to be made perfect through sufferings. Hebrews 5:8-9, by the things which he suffered, he was made perfect. Christ was perfect in himself, but not perfect in his office. He was made perfect as a captain of our salvation when he went through those things in which others were to follow him. Number three, that he might be able to comfort his people in the like distresses, Hebrews 2:18, for in that he himself hath suffered, being tempted, he is able to succor them that are tempted. A man can the better comfort others when he has had the experience of their miseries in himself. Christ knew how sad it was with his own soul when he was acquainted with these griefs, and therefore no doubt he is willing and able to help you. Experienced men are pitiful, or they have pity for others. Those that have suffered pity others when they are in the like case. It is God's charge often to Israel that having been strangers in the land of Egypt, they should learn to pity strangers. And certainly whatever is good in the creature is eminently so in Christ. He has stronger impressions of affection and pity than we have. Mark what the apostle said in Hebrews 4:15, for we have not a high priest that cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but was in all things tempted as we are, yet without sin. Christ knew how it was with himself. In the like experiences and afflictions, therefore, it cannot but work upon his bowels, though men's hearts are shut up. To apply it now, out of all that I have spoken to you, you may infer much for your instruction. Number one, the matter, what he suffered. Number two, the manner, how he came to suffer. Number three, the reasons and ends or purposes why, for our good, so that here are three chief lessons for a Christian to learn. Number one, patience and comfort. Number two, humility. Number three, in the end, love. Number one, it teaches you patience and comfort. There is a double ground for that. Christ went before you, and he did it that he might have experience and a fellow feeling of your case and sufferings. Here is the comfort of God's people. They have a high priest that is touched with the feeling of their infirmities. Christ's bowels melt over them while God's hand strikes them. A man may have moral grounds of comfort, but here is the true ground. Christ sympathizes with us. John 18:10, the cup which my Father hath given me, shall I not drink it? Though it is a bitter cup, yet it is my heavenly Father that has put it into my hands. There is a difference between the strokes of God upon the wicked and his own people. Strokes upon the wicked come from God's hand, but those upon the godly from God's heart. Bear up, then, against the greatest crosses. Are you looked upon as an abject, the leaving off of men? So was Christ, and so are many of God's people. 1 Corinthians 4:13. We are made as the filth of the world and are as the offscouring of all things. The world's filth, worms, not men. Worms are bred out of the world's filth. Are you compassed about with losses, affliction upon affliction, like waves one on the neck of the other? Do men hide their faces from you? Are you in no repute and no respect with them? So was Christ, and Christ knows what it is for you to be in such a case. Job hears of loss upon loss from the Chaldeans, Sabians, Job 1:14. It is often repeated, while he was yet speaking, came another and said, so Jeremiah 30, verse 17, Zion, whom no man looketh after. God's people have often become the wagging of the head, but Christ's sufferings teach us patience. Number two, humility. Christ taught us this in his meanness or lowness, and he teaches it in his sufferings. See the difference between Christ and Adam. Christ would be most abject, Adam would be higher than man. The highest is become the humblest. Our first parents would be as gods, and Christ would scarce be as man, even be man's leavings. It is good to learn humility from this pattern showed us in the Mount, even in Mount Calvary, to deny ourselves to set up Christ, as Christ denied himself to set up us. Of all things, men cannot endure to cast their crowns at the Lamb's feet. I mean, to sacrifice their glory and esteem to Christ, or to be nothing that he may be all in all. Pride is like the heart, first living and last dying in a man. 3 John 9, Diotrephes loved to have the preeminence. Some are all for precedency. They would be preferred before others. You see, Christ is otherwise. He freely submitted himself to the most abject condition, and thus it teaches us humility. Third, considering the end or purpose, his love, all this was for you. Oh, what will you do for God again? Christians should blow up the fire of love by these thoughts. How are we wrought upon by every petty kindness that passes between man and man? How much more, then, should the consideration of what Christ has done and suffered endear him to us? And this was done for our sakes. Let it melt our hearts and draw them out in love to God again. All right, that is the end of doctrine number one, which was that Christ's appearance in the world and state of life among men was not only very mean or low, but very miserable. And he goes on to doctrine two, but we're going to go ahead and stop there for now, and Lord willing, go on to doctrine two next time. But until then, go contemplating these things of Christ, and may these bring us to patience and comfort and humility, and may they draw out our hearts in great love to him for the so great love that he has shown. And Lord willing, we will talk to you again soon.